The Guardian.
I'm Alex Duval-Smith, and for this Guardian Global Development podcast, I've come to Timbuktu in northern Mali. It's been a year since President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita was elected to run a country whose development challenges, education, malnutrition, sanitation, are as acute as they come. Mali is in the bottom dozen of the United Nations Development Programme's World Development Index, and of course more than 2 years of crisis have made matters worse. I'll be going round Timbuktu, speaking to people about their everyday challenges. Then I'll take my impressions to the capital, Bamako, and put them to a politician, to an activist, and to a man from the International Monetary Fund. There are now 1,200 United Nations police and military in Timbuktu, 10,000 in the whole of Mali. There are at least 1,500 French troops. They're here to bring things back to normal, but normal is not good enough. Normal was the state that prevailed pre-2012. Tuareg mercenaries came back from Libya. They used their weaponry to stage a rebellion. The neglected Malian army revolted and ousted the president. Then Islamists linked to Al-Qaeda took advantage of the chaos. Mali will achieve only one of the Millennium Development Goals, access to improved water. At least 40% of the population lives more than 5 kilometres from a health centre. UNICEF says neonatal problems, malaria, pneumonia and diarrhoea still account for 70% of under-5 deaths. Malnutrition prevalence in under-5s is 27%. 90% of girls and women have undergone genital cutting. 6 out of 10 are married before the age of 18. Then you have a population growth rate, which at 3.6% is in the world's top 5. According to the United Nations, the crisis affected 2.8 million people. More than 100,000 Malians, mainly Tuaregs, are still refugees in neighbouring countries. A year since his election, President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita has not sealed a peace deal with the northern armed groups. People are still very afraid. The buildings here are low-rise and clay brick. The streets are paved here in the city centre, but there are drifts of sand across them. All this dust has a peculiar way of deadening the sound. You don't hear a vehicle, for example, until it's really up close. Arab men run small outlets, but I'm not spotting any Tuaregs in their distinctive turbans. I get chatting to a Nigerian police inspector.
Myself, I've been here for about a year.
About a year?
Yeah.
So you've seen the situation change quite a lot, I imagine, if you compare with when you arrived.
Yeah, tremendously. We arrived here about 28 July 2013. There were nobody. So we started patrol. People were happy. But now the place is full. People are here. The town is filled up with people. So with our presence and patrols, so I believe people had confidence to come back.
You can't miss the United Nations police in their sky blue helmets and bulletproof vests. Our foot patrol through the narrow streets of Timbuktu is all about a show of presence. The officers are Senegalese, Beninois, Turkish and Nigerian. Most of them can't even have a conversation with the locals. They're no crack force either. Many are rather portly. They look like they're more used to sitting in an office than patrolling in heavy body armour in the stifling heat. But in the absence of an effective Malian police force, they've brought back a sense of order, and it makes a change from the harsh Islamist order that Al-Qaeda imposed in 2012. Near the 12th century Jinga Ribert Mosque in Timbuktu, I walk into Hausa Tandina's house. Hausa Tandina is 35. She has 5 children. Her husband, Umar Jex, used to work in a hotel, but he's unemployed now. Mrs. Tandina makes ice in a tall freezer. She sells it to a man who calls twice a day on his motorbike and buys each lump for 25 francs. That's 5 US cents. He then rides down to the Niger River, 18 kilometres away, and sells the ice to fishermen. Soldiers' wives used to have the monopoly on ice making because electricity was free in the Malian army barracks. But the soldiers and their families ran away when the Islamists came. Mrs. Tandina and hundreds of other Timbuktu women have filled the gap. She also sells patties and juices outside a school. She sells fabric and jewellery that she buys in Bamako. But last time she took the 48-hour trip to the capital to collect stock, the bus she was travelling on was attacked by bandits on the way back.
It was around 8 p.m. There was machine gun fire. They blocked the road with a truck. Everyone out, on the ground, face down, hands on our backs. They took all my stock, my phone, some silver necklaces I had bought. The value was 190,000 francs. I don't know who they are, but as soon as you're outside Timbuktu, they're everywhere. That attack really hurt me a lot. We really just want peace. We are trying to pick up from having lost everything. And then, once again, we lose everything.
At least Mrs. Tandina lives in town, with its UN police patrols and nighttime curfew. Médecins Sans Frontières has been in Timbuktu since 2012, but it's scaled down its coverage of the Timbuktu region since March this year, when a mobile clinic was targeted for a car hijacking. This means MSF are only in the city centre. The region, which is the size of Nigeria, has little or no health coverage. Head of MSF Mali, Dr. Youssoufou Salia.
The main challenge is how to set up good security in order to help the population in the rural area, 200 to 300 kilometres from the town.
Because the health centres outside the city aren't working, is that right?
The health center are not fully working. There is no ambulance, system of ambulance to refer the patient in the hospital. And there is this problem of security.
What strikes me when I'm in Timbuktu is that you can count on the fingers of one hand the international NGOs that are there. There's PLAN, there's Handicap, there's MSF, there's NRC, and there's the Danish Refugee Council.
Yeah.
That's it. That's one hand.
Yeah.
And yet Bamako is full of WHO, IOM, IRC, everybody's in Mali. But why are they not where they need to be?
Yeah, of course, all the humanitarian and UN, they try to make their best. But it seems to be that the problem of Mali in the north is start to become like something that people start to forget. But the need is there.
What, in terms of the health of the population, are you observing?
The people are coming at the end. So we are running the hospital of 91 bed capacity, in which the ministry staff are not back.
This is a problem, isn't it? Anything in the public sector has been depopulated in the north, and it's been very difficult for the authorities to get staff to go back. I mean, to what extent is it sustainable in the long run? MSF can't presumably keep paying the staff of Timbuktu. It should be Malians.
Yeah, MOH staff are very worried about the security, and they have to come back. Of course, we are not going to stay for 5-6 years. We have the limit.
I've come to the centre of Mali's capital, Bamako, to a little office occupied by Anton Opdebeker, the resident representative of the International Monetary Fund. In May 2013, 5 months after the start of the French military intervention, international donors met in Brussels and pledged a whopping 3.2 billion euros, or $4.4 billion, to get Mali back on its feet. That amount included some direct budgetary support. A year on, in May this year, the donors came to Bamako. Days before the meeting, this diminutive Dutch economist revealed that President Keita's administration had bought a presidential jet for $40 million on the sly. Without going to Parliament, the presidency had also provided a $200 million guarantee for defence spending. I asked Opdebeke if he thought aid money had been used to buy the Boeing 737.
The donors pledged basically to resume their aid at the old level, or in fact at a somewhat higher level. So the $3.2 billion is being disbursed in the course of 2013, 14, and 15, in the form of a resumption of the old aid relations.
That includes direct budgetary
support. That includes an amount of budget support. And so, yes, that money would have paid for a little bit of the presidential plane, you can say.
So, in other words, once it's budget support, you really can't do very much about how it's spent.
Exactly. And we, the IMF, we don't generally take issue with specific spending items, but you can imagine if you're a donor, you may want to reconsider your budget support.
And which indeed is what's happening, because the World Bank and the other donors who give direct budgetary support, such as the European Union and I think the Danes and the Norwegians, have also deferred their payment.
Yeah, once we decided that we could not complete our review in June, all the donors who had budget support that was about to be disbursed informed the government that they were suspending their disbursements until these issues were resolved.
How serious is that for the Treasury?
Donor assistance to Mali's budget in 2014 is around $900 million. And of that amount, about $340 million is budget support. In principle, no strings attached.
But how much of the budget stems from budget support?
It would be about 12% of government, say 12-15%, 1/6 of government spending is budget support.
Does that mean that if the deferments were to continue, or if international donors were to cool in terms of giving direct budget support, which it is my sense that they have cooled, this could have an impact on government spending on teacher salaries, nurses' salaries, hospitals, health centres?
In the past, we have seen that the government makes of salaries its number one priority. So in the case of such a setback, what normally suffers is the investment spending. So I would say not nurses' salaries, but new clinics, not teacher salaries, but new schools.
President Keita came to power with 77% of the vote. His slogan was Le Mali d'abord, Mali first. But several nepotistic appointments later, his critics accuse him of putting his family first. They question spending priorities like the jet and point to the lack of progress over peace. What you can't take away from IBK, as he's known, is that he's given a chance to a new generation of politicians. I've come to Parliament in Bamako to meet the youngest of them, Amadou Thiam. He's 30 and is already second Deputy Speaker of Parliament.
The President Ibeka did a lot. First of all, in his government, there was the creation of a Minister for Reconciliation. And secondly, there was also a ministry that was in charge of the development of the northern regions of Mali. And third, he also nominated Modibo Keita as the high representative of the head of state as to the talks between Mali, the government of Mali, and the different armed groups. So all these efforts towards reconciliations will lead to a definite peace agreement. If we take also the economy of Mali, the government has been able to sort of stabilize the prices of the basic foodstuff.
What was done to stabilize the prices?
There were lots of subsidies. So all those subsidies have been maintained despite all the economic hardships. I'll also say in the domain of fighting against corruption, the government has initiated a law against illicit enrichment. There have also been some flaws.
You're referring to the presidential jet?
Yeah, the presidential jet. So it's created a lot of talks around it. I personally think that government could have done a lot to avoid all the wrath of the IMF that we have today and other partners. There's been a problem as to the procedure.
I mean, my reading has been that there's been a lot of effort spent on institutional reform, laws being passed. But Mali has a historic problem, which goes back from before the crisis, of implementation being poor. Has the ordinary Malian seen change for the better?
We are coming from a major crisis. The president has been more concentrated on how to come to normalization.
Among President Ibeka's and the parliament's priorities, how highly does development rank? How highly does poverty alleviation rank? We never hear that rhetoric from the Malian government.
Poverty alleviation, development. You know, you wouldn't probably hear development much. There is no development without peace.
Why has it taken a year to get the government and the armed groups to the negotiating table when it was supposed to happen within 60 days of the president's election?
It's taken a year because of so many issues. First of all, the armed groups were supposed to be camped, which wasn't the case. So there was a sort of reluctance from both sides, because both sides, you know, wanted to sort of be on a certain position of force, you know, before talks would begin, which is normal in any conflict, you know.
It's assumed that Mali will not reach a number of the Millennium Development Goals. If you look forward, if you look at the plans for the coming year, do you see plans which will have an impact on Mali's development scores?
Yeah, I'm very hopeful because now we are sure that the peace talks that have started in Algiers are on a good run. There are so many companies, so many investors who are waiting at the door. So once we are able to sign a definite peace treaty or agreement, they will invest in Mali. And definitely there will be lots of financial aid. Because now it's because of this same crisis that institutions like IMF, World Bank are a bit reluctant. And once they come in full-fledged, so many other bilateral aids will come in. That's why everybody agrees that we should, you know, expedite the peace talks in order to come to a peace agreement, which will definitely encourage development.
But here and now, things aren't rosy. So why do Malians find themselves in such a precarious position? Where is the country headed? I've come down to the Quartier du Fleuve. The International Monetary Fund is housed in the public debt office. Joining me again is the local representative of the IMF, Anton Opdebeker. This time, we're also with the civil society activist, Kumba Ba. Can you introduce yourself, Kumba?
Thank you very much, Alex. I'm Kumba Ba, mother of four. I'm currently working in civil aviation, but my background is really in chemistry. And I'm a Malian citizen who, since the last event of 2012, has really decided to be active in the life of my country.
Over the past, I would say, up to a decade of Africa emerging, Africa rising, great growth scores in certain countries, that hasn't happened in Mali. Could I turn to you, Anton, and give us an idea? I think, of course, there was a crisis in 2012, but I think one can, with this question, look a bit further back and ask, why didn't Mali get on that bandwagon?
If you look back, say, two decades, and Mali has had an average annual growth rate of about 5% in real terms. That's not negligible. With a population growth rate of 3 to 3.5%, that's clearly not enough. What's holding Mali back? I would say the most significant general explanation would be the poor governance. Also, another, if we've done studies at the IMF comparing good Asian performers with comparable countries in Africa, and one striking factor is that in those Asian countries, the productivity in agriculture is much higher than in Africa.
Kumba, what's sometimes forgotten is that Mali is Africa's third gold producer. Of course, it's some way behind South Africa and Ghana, but, you know, there's potential here. So in your view, as somebody here, why isn't Mali on the fast train?
Mali always say we are an agricultural country, but the agriculture is really done the middle-age way. And it's done by people who have not gone to school, who are labeled as peasants and second-class citizens. They are not given the education, the knowledge, the technical knowledge, the scientific knowledge, the market knowledge that really they need to build their business. It's very inefficient sector. What really bothers me sometimes is knowing that actors like Anton, they know very much what's happening, but they keep working with the system.
The IMF's role here is to make sure that the government has a budget that can finance adequate education spending and in fact help them to augment this budget. But it's not our mandate to discuss with the authorities, with the government, you know, the details of their education policy.
Yeah, again, that's what adds continuously to the questioning, because yet they know it's not working, but they don't want to reinvent the process. There is money given, but when money was given, there was no follow-up. There was no accountability. Yes, you put a lot of money in agriculture, but I know we are not talking about the World Bank, but has anybody done an evaluation, an audit of the productivity and the meeting of a goal? We put $30 billion in this agricultural sector to have this much done in rice. Can we go and see if that rice has been produced? And if the rice has been produced, is it been stocked properly? What is meant to be shipped out of the country, sold to have value added? Is that being done? But the government just sit and send you a report. How many people were trained? We have done so many forums, so many symposiums. I don't care if you have done 1,000 meetings and the peasants has not increased its productivity. To me, it's a failure.
All the questions that you just put about the effectiveness of spending, the Mali government should be willing and should be able to answer these questions, because that's how you improve your policies. And that is part and parcel of what we call governance. So we want the government to become more effective so that they can answer these questions empirically, use numbers, look at the money spent, at the results achieved, and then discuss with civil society. Civil society, but of course also the political system, the assembly. But eventually the push has to come from the Malians.
Yes, the push will come from the Malian. But whenever we have an opportunity to lobby with partners like yourself, we will do so, because we also know you have more power on our government than we do. The sooner Malians have a critical mass that really looks after the government, the better for the whole worldwide. Because if something happens here, it's your resources, it's taxpayer money from developed countries that are gathered to come help. So why don't we change the policy to target to the priorities?
And Anton, is and has the IMF been guilty of a kind of one-size-fits-all approach to the economies of Africa? Mali is a particular country. I was looking at some of the figures. Not only does it receive $900 million of aid every year, but it also receives $350 million of remittances from its diaspora. Now, this makes it a country of people who receive. This makes it a country of people who, not all of them, are working for the money they receive. I'm not saying that Malians are rolling in money, but I think it creates a particular dependency culture. You can't have a one-size-fits-all approach to Mali.
Yeah, the IMF is often accused of a one-size-fits-all approach. Obviously, that's not true, but we consider countries on their characteristics, but let's be honest, in practice there are lots of similarities between countries. If the IMF is not a development finance institution. Our contribution is fairly small, in fact, and it's expensive money, I would say, and it's short term. The IMF's lending is just to permit us to have these sorts of programs with the government that allow the government to discipline itself and benefit from our technical assistance and show to their own population and to the donors that they are moving in the right direction. The people here need to get away from the financing and look at the quality. I think there's a lot to be achieved with better quality policies. At the same time, we believe that there is a lot of scope here to raise more revenue locally. We think that currently Mali has about 15% of GDP fiscal revenue ratio. We think it could easily be a quarter to a third higher. So by reducing tax evasion, by minimizing the exemptions in the tax system, and it's not going to come from abroad, it'll have to come from Mali.
Kumba, just spinning off from my earlier question to Anton, is Mali in a dependency culture?
We are very much becoming dependent on foreign, and we are even like sitting and waiting like beggars. Yes, the Malian diaspora send a lot of money in, but I have a feeling that 90% of the money that is sent by diaspora is all eaten for no business development whatsoever. But also, if you look at the foreigners that when come, they help us. I don't know if you look at the Malian TV, for example. There will be reports, oh, so many people, you know, Visa partner came and gave 3 million. They will spend over 750,000 to just have reports done to show that they're giving 3 million. What is 3 million? Like, we just passed Ramadan. Ramadan, every day, there were donations being shown on TV. And everybody comes to have 1 liter of oil and 1 kilo of sugar. What is that, if it's not begging culture?
I can certainly sympathize with what Kumba just said. When I read the newspapers, I'm also struck by the large number of articles on donor initiative, donor projects. What I would like to see is for the government to produce more results and report on its results. The budget is full of initiatives. You know, in the end, the donors finance only about a quarter of the budget. So there is 3/4 of spending that is not donor linked, and government should become more results oriented. I'm glad this is part of this government's strategy. They're just at the beginning of it. They need to, for all of their policies, start formulating strategies, concrete objectives, and then compile the data for following the achievements towards these objectives.
So a problem of communication coming from the government, do you see that as well, Kumba?
Of course, that's obvious. But when you speak to your own population in a language you know very well they don't understand, what are you trying to do? Because even if you do tweets, Facebook, internet, how many of us are on Twitter? Please, let's restitute to the Malian, have debates in the language that they understand.
So we're coming back to better communication needed from the government, an enhanced relationship between the government and the people. Could I ask you to finish, both of you, to look forward a bit? If those were those two elements on a wish list, what more would be on the wish list to actually accelerate Mali's development now from this point on? Kumba?
Really, we need to be able to reinvent things. I think humans are so intelligent. We do not need to copy and paste. Currently, the country is mainly youth who are not productive. So the adults who are productive that have not been to school, we know adults learn in a different manner than kids. So we need to have education tools designed to the adults who are still have 10 years, 20 years of production, because there are some people who do not produce one thing during the whole year. They just wait with their palms open. They do not add anything.
Totally agree. The economists would say to create more human capital. So that's by investing in education, effective education, all sorts of education, mm-hmm. but of course also health, and then in physical infrastructure, the road structure, the energy infrastructure. That with a better private sector operating environment, you need a strong government that supports the private sector in doing what private sectors around the world have proven that they are best at.
I want to add something, because what Anton said is so right, but again, to me, it's really not proper to our specific situation. Training is first. Why put billions into health sector, but you don't tell people, please, the first thing is for you to be clean. And so, because we are at that basic level.
A strong government, effective education, a better business environment, suitable infrastructure, security, the list is long. Direct budget support to the government will not resume until at least December. Since the presidential jet incident, international donors have become filled with hesitation about how to support Mali. President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita's government has failed to convince. Mali is actually in a very similar place to what it was when it was plunged into chaos by the Islamist occupation. Yet energetic activists like Kumba Ba and to some extent the young MP Amadou Thiam emerged from that crisis. They're Mali's greatest hope. I'm going to leave you with another young Malian, the 24-year-old musician, M. Das. A member of the Timbuktu Regional Orchestra, he's in Bamako now. He fled his city after spending 2 days in Islamic police custody. They threatened to cut off his tongue. A prominent imam intervened and M. Das was released. He fled on a motorbike across the desert in the dead of night. Here he's singing a cappella, the last song performed by the regional orchestra, 1 week before the Islamist occupation began in 2012. It's a cry to God for divine intervention to bring peace to Mali. For Guardian Global Development, I'm Alex Duval-Smith in Timbuktu.
Muhammad Rasulullah, yer koi sima chilafo.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.